Welcome back to Copper Country Today. I'm your host, Rick Allen. We're a little ways away from election season. It's a good time to get to know some of the people that are running, and we're going to do that in this segment. I welcome in Matt Morgan. He is a candidate for the Michigan's 1st Congressional District. Matt, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for having me.
Now, let's talk a little bit about where you're from. Traverse City, correct?
I live in Traverse City now. My wife and I went there after I retired from the Marine Corps in 2013. We had two young boys. We retired out of Norfolk, Virginia, and we wanted to come back to Michigan to raise the boys.
Now, you're visiting us here in the Houghton area, part of a UPY tour, and I just want to mention, I believe I read somewhere that your wife is originally from Lawrence.
My wife spent her early years in Lawrence. Her father was the high school principal there for a number of years, so if any of the listeners went to Lawrence High School in the 70s, they probably remember Mr. Judge.
Okay, great. And what made you decide you wanted to run for this office?
Well, I retired from the Marine Corps after just over 20 years, and I never really had any aspiration or intention of running for political office. But after the last election, there were some things that I was deeply concerned about. The one that's closest to me in terms of where we live is we chose to live in Michigan for a reason, because, you know, of the waters here and the beautiful country. And we want to be making sure that we are responsibly protecting our resources while at the same time being able to invest in infrastructure and create jobs and do these types of things. And I was very concerned that the new administration didn't have a full understanding of that. And the beginning of the year, when the new Congress took office, it was very clear in terms of their implementation of policy that they were not going to be pursuing these types of initiatives with our natural resources and those types of things at the center. And so I was asked to consider running for office, and I realized that, you know, as a Marine, you look for opportunities to lead, and I couldn't ask anybody else to do this if I wasn't willing to do it myself. And so we decided as a family to take this on.
Now, I think at this date there are three Democrats running on that side for this seat. The Republican, of course, incumbent would be Jack Bergman. If you were to get that nomination, then we would have two veterans going head to head for the congressional seat. Jack, of course, has a long career in the military as well. Having one yourself, I believe you're a lieutenant colonel, correct?
Right. I retired as a lieutenant colonel, and it's difficult to directly compare any individual veteran's service with another. Jack and I share the fact that we are both Marines. We did not serve together, but we share probably about a half a dozen single degrees of separation. I know he knows very well an officer who mentored me through much of my career. But I would make a distinction and offer a bit of contrast between us. Jack is a Vietnam veteran, tremendous amount of respect for him as a combat helicopter pilot in that regard, but he's also a Cold Warrior. I'm a post 9/11 combat veteran. I've served on the ground about 18 months total in Iraq, about half a year in the Horn of Africa supporting counterterrorism operations there. So being a post 9/11 combat veteran, I believe that Jack and I just have entirely different worldviews.
Have you always been a Democrat?
Actually, I started my life, I would say, as a younger man. I tended to be more conservative. I was raised in a more conservative, traditional household. The thing for me that really shaped my worldview was going to Iraq in 2003. I lived for 3 weeks at the beginning of that, wearing chemical protective overgarments. I slept every night with a gas mask on my forehead. And I came home with some concerns that we'd been lied to in some respects. And everyone has a little bit different perspective on the nuances of that issue. But in 2006, I finished grad school and went to work in the Pentagon under then Secretary Don Rumsfeld. And it was a very difficult time. I think the United States was looking at ramping up and trying to determine how exactly we're going to exit Iraq, what the strategy looked like. And so I had the opportunity at that point, when the United States committed surge forces to Iraq, to volunteer to go back. At that time, I went back for a year. So seeing that from the inside out, being in the Pentagon then again under Secretary Gates, and experiencing the transition to the Obama administration, I have a very committed worldview, I think, in terms of from Democrat-type ideals. I will say, though, that I've been extremely frustrated with Democrats and the Democratic candidates in their inability to understand and talk to working families about the issues that impact their day-to-day lives. A lot of the top-down messaging that comes from the Democratic Party in Washington today tends to be ineffective and I think disconnected with everyday working Americans. So when people talk about the party, I tell them, we're running our campaign here. And what I hear when we're on the ground talking with everyday Michiganders is their concerns are the types of things that affect working families that are working two jobs to make ends meet. They want to be able to take their kid to the doctor when they're sick, and they want to have a future. They want to know that their job is going to be secure and that their kids are going to have a good education and opportunities right here in the UP.
Now, of course, you have to run in one of the, I think it's the largest congressional district. If, I know certainly in the state, it might even be among the biggest in the country as far as size, having to travel. And then, of course, you're talking with people in the Upper Peninsula, your wife being from Lawns. Issues that we deal with are going to be different than those that are being dealt with in Alpena and Traverse City. So talking with people here in the Upper Peninsula, what are you seeing that's a concern for them?
Well, the one thing that makes the UP distinct is its rich heritage in terms of mineral extraction and timber. And people here in the UP want to make sure that we are able to continue to mine responsibly and timber these natural resources responsibly as well. Those are really important, not just in terms of being able to provide jobs, but being able to provide a tax base to support our education programs. And we can do that. We can continue to do that responsibly. That is a very different set of concerns than I hear on a day-to-day basis in the Lower Peninsula, where there's a great deal more focus on in terms of preserving and protecting the Great Lakes. Jobs in the tourism industry, which is booming there, but a tremendous lack of good paying jobs in the middle. But in the end, we're all kind of unified by the fact that we want our kids to get a good education, we want to have good job opportunities, and we want to be able to continue to enjoy the natural resources that really are probably one of the big reasons why we live here and why people come here to live.
Of course, we've got some mining operations that are continuing here in the Upper Peninsula. We also have some exploratory operations going on. Highland Copper, a Canadian company that's been doing some exploratory drilling here in the local area. It's created a little bit of a stir because, you know, some people are very much adamant against, you know, disturbing the natural resources and some of the, you know, the destruction that we've seen in the past with mining operations. How familiar are you with, you know, what's going on you know, with their attempts to explore mines in White Pine, Gogebic, and then even up in the Keweenaw?
Right. I've been watching that very carefully. As a matter of fact, we were just at Copper Peak yesterday, and we're talking about some of the exploration and the future opportunities development there. One of the things that has happened in terms of the polarization or the politicization of the arguments has been that we've been given a false choice. This notion that protecting the environment means losing jobs, or that creating jobs means destroying the environment. That's fact of false choice. We can mine in a manner that's environmentally responsible. We can create jobs in the process of being environmentally responsible, and we need to take advantage of all those opportunities to be able to do so.
What are some of the factors that are keeping us from being able to advance and get more jobs in this area?
Well, the biggest contributor to the loss of mining and manufacturing jobs has been automation. And we're going to continue to see automation disrupting jobs in those sectors and others over the coming decades. So the big important point for us is that first we need to be able to educate our kids in career tech fields that are going to be the future. We need to have the opportunity and the capacity to train our existing workforce and to retrain the workforce as the jobs that they have are replaced by automation and we create new jobs. So that's one of the keys for us. I think that even when you say we're going to reopen this copper mine, we're going to open a new copper mine, it's not like when that meant 700 jobs. It's more like 150 jobs now in that type of environment, in large part because of automation. So we have to be aware of that. We have to be looking for new opportunities. And as we are using our existing resources, we need to remain focused on 21st century energy opportunities, and particularly in renewable energies, and understand how that transition works. I don't believe there is any single silver bullet in terms of renewable energy. We can't throw the switch overnight and just say we're no longer going to use fossil fuels and we're only going to use wind or solar. This is a transition that's going to take the better part of the next century in order to effectively do it. So from my perspective, it is let's preserve the jobs that we currently have in things like the petroleum industry, responsibly transition forward into transition renewables as we wean ourselves off of things like petroleum products, more toward things like wind if they work in that area, natural gas, continue to use that to the degree that we can, move toward geothermal technologies. I mean, there's no single silver bullet. We have to be looking at all of these opportunities. And the great thing is that there's a lot of jobs in that.
You have a, you'll find a lot of people open to some sort of idea to doing something differently than we're doing now, because we pay the highest rates in the country. That, you know, you can go to Hawaii and find electric rates cheaper than what we're paying here, and it's really hard. It creates quite a hardship on families here that, you know, that that are struggling just to make ends meet, to remain in the area without having to leave the area. And then if you're trying to pitch, you know, a manufacturing plant to move here, and then they see sort of the cost of operations, not only with the cost of energy here, but then the cost of transportation. These are in the lack of high-speed internet is another one. So these are, you know, sort of roadblocks, major obstacles that, you know, people have great ideas. They love to see us move, you know, win jobs and have companies move here and take advantage of, you know, a ready workforce and a great place to live. But yet these things keep getting in the way.
Right. Well, you mentioned internet. You know, broadband penetration is probably one of the most critical infrastructure issues facing the UP. And the way that we currently measure it is ineffective in telling us exactly how and where we need to expand, because we're using this census block data that paints a prettier picture than actually exists. And I know that your listeners are probably shaking their head right now in terms of, yeah, this is a big problem, because you could have great internet, you know, in one location, and a half a mile away, you've got nothing. So we have to be able to expand this, and we've got a model for it. Rural electrification is a model for how we can expand broadband internet access. And if we can't do that, if we don't provide broadband internet, we're not going to attract businesses. We're not going to have families here. If you attract a business, then the family is going to want a certain quality of life. They're going to want a quality of education. The education certainly relies a great deal on broadband as well. And then that same truth extends on in terms of the other infrastructure that we have to deal with, and which we traditionally think of in terms of, you know, roads and bridges. And I'm very impressed in large part by a lot of the roads and the highways that you have in the UP. They're actually in better shape in a lot of ways than what we have in the lower. But we need to continue to look at the key things that are going to drive us, you know, access to health care. Rural health care is a big issue. And I think that we're going to see a transition more and more to telecare. That's going to force rural users, particularly the aging population, to get more of their health care and do their consultation for acute care with physicians over the internet. And so, again, we go back to this infrastructure issue.
Well, people are also going to be interested in how, if you were in Congress right now, you know, your thoughts on things that are they're handling. So let's take the big one, the health care. Republicans attempt to repeal, possibly replace the Affordable Care Act. You're watching this from the sidelines. How do you feel about that debate?
Well, let's just look in terms of what we have here in this district. We have 14 critical access hospitals. 11 of those are right here in the UP. And if they were to contract and or close, we're talking about not just the loss of healthcare, but in those communities that they exist in, they're the number one employer. They're an anchor employer that have about 12 other businesses probably that rely on the hospital's presence there. So this isn't just a healthcare issue. It becomes a major economic issue for the region. What is being proposed, or what has been proposed under the AHCA, the new Republican healthcare bill, would be a disaster for rural healthcare. It would more dramatically impact rural healthcare than any other aspect of the industry itself, because we're going to see that hit those communities. All of the hospitals that I visit here, they talk in terms of pharmaceutical costs being one of the most substantial challenges that they face on a daily basis. About a quarter of the costs that a hospital deals with are because of pharmaceutical costs. If we can't get that under control, then we're facing a long-term issue. And that's really one of the biggest weaknesses of Obamacare, was that they didn't address the pharma issue. We have to be able to do better, and we can look at a number of different models around the world. I mean, what is happening today is that Americans are paying the cost of developing pharmaceuticals that the rest of the world is getting for wholesale.
The latest word is that if they do a repeal of the Obamacare but then don't replace it, they would have a 2-year phase out. Seems to go neatly with the fact that it would phase out after the 2018 elections. So if that was to happen, and if you were to win a seat there, you may find yourself in Congress when it comes up to, you know, when the Affordable Care Act would officially be ending. Do you move towards bringing it back, going to something completely different, perhaps single payer? What would you like to see this go to?
Well, you've got two issues that you have to address in terms of this problem. One is that you need insurance reform. The other is that you have to reform the system itself. Reforming the system is a significant issue. As I mentioned before, I think you take on the pharmaceutical costs. Long term, look, I was in the Marine Corps for over 20 years. I had the purest form of single payer health any individual could have. And the nice thing about it was is everything you imagine about single payer. I could go to the doctor. I didn't even need an appointment. I could be seen by a nurse practitioner or a physician assistant. If I needed to be referred to an MD, I could. If not, they would write me a prescription. I'd go pick it up at the window. I'd walk out and no money would change hands. The other side of that is that the military does a very good job of managing wellness, because we have to do that in terms of readiness. If you don't have a healthy force, then you don't have a ready force. In any single payer system, you would have to find a way to manage and incentivize wellness, that is, getting to the doctor annually for your checkup, making sure that your kids are properly immunized, dental care. I mean, dental care is a massive component of this, because oral care relates directly to heart health. So that's a key component, and we would have to look at how we're going to do that. I think that long term, there may be a place for insurance companies in it, but not in the way that they currently invest right now. It doesn't work like any other insurance out there. The fact is that we all have a pre-existing condition. We are all going to die someday. We are all going to need significant health care more and more as we age. So we have to confront that fact in order to be able to reform the system and address the gaps that we currently face.
Okay. Let's change directions a little bit here. Let's go to immigration. And I'm interested to see what your thoughts are, especially with, like, you know, Trump's travel ban and such. So somebody has served in the Middle East. And whether or not you feel that that's an effective policy, does it help, you know, improve the safety of Americans, or does it backfire in any way?
The Trump travel ban is an ineffective remedy to a problem that does not exist. We're talking about banning individuals from certain countries based on some sort of preconception that really doesn't bear out in terms of the types of threat that we have faced over the long term. And the downside of it is, you know, when I worked in the Pentagon, I worked on a project that was targeted at countering violent extremist recruiting in vulnerable populations. And that effectively means this recognition that we can't simply kill our way out of this problem. We're going to continue to create more. And policies like this travel ban do nothing but support the propaganda that our adversaries are putting out there. I'll tell you, I've served in Muslim countries, and I've been around riots and demonstrations, and anytime anybody's out there burning an American flag, an effigy, I will tell you that I could stop that riot in 1 minute if I were able to set up a booth on the corner with a sign that said, "Visas here." If any one of those individuals would give their eye teeth for an opportunity to come to America. That's what they still desire very much. So this travel ban, I think, is a significant issue. And in effect, the way the Supreme Court has managed its implementation, it's rendered it generally ineffective in terms of its overall intent in the first place. I think in terms of immigration overall, we have to understand, acknowledge that as a country, if we want to grow this economy, immigration is essential to that. We have to have a mechanism to bring people into this country who want to work. And I'll take this right back to healthcare. You know, it's not just about individuals coming into the country to pick fruit. It's about doctors and nurses being able to come to this country, because rural health communities rely upon those. I mean, go to your local hospital and go and look at the list of doctors and their pictures on the wall. It's very clear that to us that we rely upon immigration in terms of our medical care to provide health care to these communities.
But it's easier to say that you support immigration, like in a legal sense, of, you know, people, you know, wanting to come to this country, getting a visa, coming to it, but then wanting to stop, you know, a flood of refugees or illegal immigration coming from the border, on the Mexican border. building a wall being one, you know, solution thrown out there by our president, and many people support those, you know, support that. What about addressing the, you know, the type of immigration that does sometimes pose a risk?
Well, we've needed comprehensive immigration reform for more than two decades, and it cost a lot of Republicans their seats to more conservative Republicans some years ago during the Tea Party wave of elections, because there were too few people who were willing to accept this path to citizenship. But George W. Bush made very clear in what he was putting forward that we have undocumented or otherwise illegal immigrants in the United States today, something on the order of 11 million. You have to have some sort of remedy to that. You can't deport them all, and you can't simply wave a wand and automatically give them citizenship. So you have to have some sort of process by which, if an individual has come to the United States legally, overstayed their visa, and done so for no other reason than they wanted to provide a better life for their family, I think a path to citizenship is a perfectly reasonable thing. And what I find is that when you put a face on that, you know, if somebody knows a hardworking Mexican immigrant, for example, they'll oftentimes say, well, yeah, but this guy's different. You know, it's like anything else. It's like if you put a face on it, this individual, this family, I've known them, they're in my church, they are in my community, you know, they've been a part of our community in general, people are far more willing to accept them. In terms of the type of immigration that is a national security threat, I have a great deal of confidence in the Department of Homeland Security and our intelligence agencies to be able to manage that on a day-to-day basis. I've seen it from the inside out. I know it can work. The idea that you're just blanket, you know, putting a blanket prohibition on people from a specific country or a handful of specific countries is largely ineffective.
I want to bring it back a little closer to home here as well for the Great Lakes. Ask anybody, should, you know, government watch the money it spends? They say, yeah, absolutely. And that's a job of a legislator to go there and manage the, you know, where the money goes. But when they suggest, you know, cutting $300 million from Great Lakes Restoration Initiative, I know that the Congress said no way to that suggestion by Trump to cut that funding for the Great Lakes. That money, well spent for our area for restoration, or, you know, an area that could be cut?
In 2005, I was at graduate school, my graduate seminar with several field grade officers from different services and several different countries, in fact, ranging from Australia to Iraq. And in those graduate seminars, we had a great deal of discussion over the next global conflict. And it was pretty well understood and agreed upon that the next grand scale global conflict was not going to be fought over ideals. It was not going to be fought over oil. It was going to be fought over access to fresh water. What we have here in the Great Lakes is like the clean water equivalent to Saudi Arabia. Okay, this is a tremendous resource. I can think of no more important way that we should be spending our national resources and our treasure than in protecting this amazing resource. Because once you lose clean water, you can't get it back. And so that is absolutely critical. And it goes beyond just tourism. Tourism is important. Tourism is an important part of our economy in many respects. And I know that a lot of communities are trying to grow that aspect of their economy, and they rely on the Great Lakes to do it. But, you know, I grew up in a farming community, and I was taught very early on there's four things that you need for life. You need sun, soil, air, and water. If you lose any one of those things, you lose the ability to grow anything. And if you can't grow anything, you don't have food. You don't have clothing, you don't have structures. So protecting the water and the air, those should be two of our most important missions in terms of responsible governance.
Usually when I'm talking to a candidate with a military background, we spend much of the conversation talking about veterans issues and other things that are affecting the military. And even though we don't have a ton of time to spend on, I still want to just ask, you know, we've seen a lot of changes in the makeup of our military over the last few years, you know, women on the front lines. You know, there was some hubbub about transgenders in the military recently and about whether or not military should pay for operations for transgenders. Just as far as that makeup for women and for, you know, homosexuals, for transgenders, any particular stance that you have?
I think the number one metric that you have to look at in terms of a ready, capable military force is how capable are they to deploy rapidly and achieve our nation's goals in the long term. I don't know. I frankly, within the Department of Defense, I was there when we were looking at the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. There was a great deal of hand-wringing being done at the time about it. And we achieved it. The armed forces were given the mission. it's done, it's not even an issue anymore. I think over the long term, the military services do a very good job of being able to implement the policies that our government, you know, chooses to implement. And I think that no matter what we do, where we go forward, I trust that the Department of Defense and the military services will do the right thing.
Man, I want to thank you for, you know, coming in. It's good to get to know somebody for the first time. And, you know, I trust we'll be talking again, especially with, since we got a little ways until the actual election. But if people want to know more about you, find out more about your campaign, where can they go do that?
MattMorganForMichigan.com. That's our website. And so that's probably the best way to get to know more about us. Or they can also find us on Facebook at Matt Morgan for Michigan.
Great. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Copper Country Today. We'll be right back.